Hello and welcome to Inside Business with Ciarán Hancock, a podcast from the Irish Times. This week we're looking at the European Super League saga. On Sunday, 12 of Europe's biggest clubs announced their plans to form a breakaway Super League, cutting adrift other clubs in Europe. Their brazen plan drew a fierce reaction from fans, politicians, current and former players, and the regulators UEFA and FIFA. By Tuesday evening, it had collapsed with six English clubs, Arsenal, Chelsea, Liverpool, Manchester United, Manchester City and Tottenham, withdrawing from the proposal. So where did it all go wrong and what next for European football and the 12 rebel clubs and their owners? To discuss this, I'm joined on the line by Ken Early of the Second Captains podcast and an Irish Times sports columnist, and by Andrew Doyle, owner of League of Ireland football club Shelburne. Ken Early, welcome to Inside Business. This plan for European Super League lasted a full 72 hours. What went wrong?
Well, I think you're giving it a bit too much credit there. I don't think we made the 72-hour mark, Ciarán. I mean, everything went wrong, really, from the beginning. I mean, it was a terrible idea presented in a really appalling way, which was chased off the stage in absolute disgrace, which was fully deserved.
It's incredible, really, because the plan, I mean, the clubs are owned by some very smart, very successful people, successful in business and other walks of life. And yet they seem to misjudge this completely. They seem to get it very wrong. And indeed, even if you look at the website and the logo and so on, it all looked a bit amateurish for something that was supposed to be a Super League and a new departure. What do you put that down to? How did they get it so badly wrong?
Well, they don't. I mean, the question of ownership is an interesting one to think about. These are the owners of these clubs. So what does that actually mean? Who owns them, really? And what does owning a football club mean? Does it mean that you can do whatever you want with it? Well, we know now it doesn't mean that. Like, I mean, it means that if the Glazer family decided to sell Manchester United in the morning, they would be the ones who would, they'd sell this commercial entity. They'd receive the money, you know, for the shares of the club. They're the owners in that sense. But they can't just do whatever they want. They're not actually the only ones that own the club. And now you can see these clubs as they all issue these groveling apologies to the fans who were angry with them, talking about key stakeholders and stuff like this. So you can see, for instance, Liverpool's apology has mentioned, we've received valuable contributions from key stakeholders, both internally and externally. Contributions, which, by the way, they didn't seek last week when they were making the decision. And now they're saying, they've been told by their players, by their coach, by their fans, we don't want this. But they thought, evidently, that they could just sort of treat the fans as customers, treat the players and the players and the coach as employees, rather than, as they now call them, stakeholders. They didn't see the need to at any point seek the consent of all the other people who were involved. That's why people were so revolted by it. That's why people were so angry about it. The idea that this little group of billionaires could go away, cook up this scheme, and then present it as a fait accompli. And all of these other hundreds of millions of people who feel like they're involved in this are just told, well, that's just the way it is. We're the owners. They're the rules. We get to do what we want, and you just have to go along with it. And people said no. And the fury and outrage that people felt when that proposition was put to them has eventually caused this little group of billionaires, it turns out, not as internally cohesive as they would have wished, to cut and run.
Yeah, Ken, interesting, obviously, that Bayern Munich, Borussia Dortmund, Paris Saint-Germain, and maybe one or two others decided not to join this breakaway, at least when it was first announced. Why do you think that was? Was that on moral grounds, and that it was an outrage, or were there financial reasons behind it? Did they just get lucky, perhaps?
Different reasons in each case. I mean, the similarity between, for instance, PSG and Bayern Munich is that both are very, very financially secure, and both are at the top of the tree in their respective countries in terms of money and power. Bayern, because they've just been accumulating wealth for so many decades and have been in such a dominant, sort of almost a monopoly position in Germany for so long. And PSG, because they've got this money from an external source, which is to say Qatar. So neither of those clubs are under the sort of financial pressure that Real Madrid claim to be under. Real Madrid's president, Florentino Perez, is probably the most humiliated of all the billionaires, because he was the only one who came forward to really speak. Well, Agnelli at Juventus also did, but Perez was the most visible. He was going to be the president of the Super League, the first president of Super League. And he's, you know, this tremendously important man in Spain. He's always had everything his own way. So to see him humiliated in this way, but okay, so the point that he was making was, we have to do this. We've had the COVID crisis. It's cost us hundreds of millions. We're all going bankrupt. We need to take this action to save football, by which he means to save Real Madrid and like a couple of other, we have to have somebody to play against. So a couple of other clubs will have to get on the rescue boat. Liverpool, also in this sort of position, having, you know, their situation is just last year, everything was going great. Then suddenly this season's been a disaster for them on the field. They're going to not make the Champions League, it looks like. And they've also lost unexpectedly like £100 million or however much it turns out to be. Massive losses due to the closure of the stadium because of the coronavirus. So just at a point when they might need to reinvest in their team, they face not only big unexpected losses due to COVID, but also unexpected losses due to underperformance on the field. So they're saying, okay, we're under massive pressure. We need to do this. You know, remember that this Super League, they're all going to get like €200-300 million up front from JP Morgan. Actually, what they're doing is refinancing. That's actually what's going on here. So your question is about PSG and Bayern. They didn't have the need to sort of refinance. They're not under that sort of pressure. But there's political reasons too. In the case of Bayern and Dortmund, these are clubs which are 50% plus one owned at a minimum, owned by their supporters. It so happens that German football supporters tend to be very against these types of things. They tend to be very against ideas which tend towards increasing the level of commercialism in football. So these clubs have to take account of that in a way that Liverpool, for instance, or Manchester United, owned in theory by these billionaires in America, they didn't think they needed to be accountable. They thought they could do what they liked with these things. I own it, I can do what I want with it. Whereas in Germany, the fact that the fans have a voice in this is formalized in the actual structure. With PSG, there's also a political consideration, which is that beIN Sports, the Qatari sports broadcaster, is signed on to broadcast the Champions League for a couple more seasons. So they've already made this sort of financial commitment to the existing structure, which was going to be obviously kind of kicked to the curb by this move. And then there's the fact that Qatar is hosting the World Cup in 2022. And maybe at this point, given that there's already been protests, sort of a protest movement developing against the Qatar World Cup, we saw it over the last international break, maybe they felt the judicious move at this point was not to be seen to be leading a further, maybe unpopular move against the existing structure, but rather to hang back and see which way the wind was blowing. And obviously that became clear pretty quickly which way the wind is blowing. And in that respect, PSG and Bayern must be feeling pretty happy about the decisions they made to stay out.
Andrew Doyle, you own Shelbourne Football Club in the League of Ireland. You're in the first division this season. Obviously the League of Ireland is one of the smaller leagues within Europe. The romance of football is such that last September, AC Milan came to Tala Stadium play Shamrock Rovers in the Europa League and brought Zlatan and all of that. Unfortunately, there were no fans in the stadium, but there was still a great buzz around the fixture. If this plan had gone ahead, that kind of fixture could never have happened again, because AC Milan would have been part of the Super League elite and Shamrock Rovers would have been on the outside looking in. And Shelbourne, back in 2004, were famously only 90 minutes away from qualifying for the Champions League group stages, taking on Deportivo La Coruña in the semi-final stages. So I'm just wondering, against all of that kind of backdrop, what you thought of this plan?
Well, I thought it was the culmination of 25 years of threats and pressure by the G14 clubs against UEFA. I think you have to look at all of this in context. Yes, there was a great match in Tala Stadium a few weeks ago or months ago. But that's a very, very rare thing these days. You have to look at the broader context. The elite clubs have been pressuring UEFA and succeeding in creating what is already a de facto closed competition. Now, the most objectionable thing, and there were many, about the Super League was that it was overtly a closed league, which breaches all of the sporting principles of the European sporting model. But if you look at the facts, in the 1970s, 40% of the clubs which won the Champions League were from outside the big five leagues. In the 1980s, it was 30%. In the 1990s, it was 20%. In the noughties, it was 10%. And guess what? In the last decade, it's been 0%. So it's already a de facto closed league. So I know there's a huge amount of emotion at play here at the moment. And it's wonderful that this thing has been dismembered in the way that it has. But if you look at what UEFA did, in fact, approve on Monday after huge pressure from those clubs, it increases the competitive imbalance problem and which arises in two guises. First of all, the big four leagues in Europe have guaranteed access to the Champions League competition proper. So the top four clubs from the big four nations get 16 of the 32 slots in the first round of the Champions League. Irish clubs have to travel all around Europe to all sorts of interesting places at enormous costs, which they can't afford, in order to have any prospect and win four of them before they have any prospect of getting to that level. So that's the first problem, which has arisen over that period and been driven over that period. The second problem is the allocation of funding is hugely biased towards the bigger leagues, even to the point where part of the funding is allocated against the size of the media rights market in those leagues, which is obviously vastly larger because they have vastly larger populations. And to give you an example, last season, Man City got to the quarterfinals of the Champions League. Disappointing performance by their standards and by their objectives. They received 100 million euro in prize money for doing that. The 40 UEFA member countries, which did not have a participating club in the round of 32 because they're financially destitute in effect, or many of them are, received in aggregate to spread across I haven't counted the exact number of clubs, it's certainly in the region of 1,000 professional clubs, just short of 26 million. So, you know, sadly and unfortunately, it is fundamentally about money and allocation of money, because since the Bosman ruling in 1995, the best players go to the biggest markets because the biggest markets have the biggest leagues because they have the most TV subscribers. And as a consequence, since 1995, the bigger leagues have got much stronger and much more powerful politically, and the smaller leagues have become much weaker. So that has resulted in a de facto closed Champions League as we have it, which will be increasingly closed now as a result of the changes that were approved on Monday and announced on Monday, which nobody has really focused on because of this other hilarious fiasco. There is no competitive balance at all. Like Celtic, for example, you take Celtic. They, the odd year, say once every 3 or 4 years, they make the round of 32 of the Champions League. Then they come up against PSG. Now, PSG playing Celtic isn't a match for PSG. It's a chore. It's something they have to get through. And I think last time they played, or the time before, Celtic lost 11 or 12-1 on aggregate. Nobody wants to see that. And that's because of the size of the market in which Celtic play. It's a tiny market. They get £2.5 million a year, approximately, in media rights income. It pales into minuscule irrelevance relative to the money that the bigger leagues receive. And the further consequence of the underlying trends over the last 25 years has been that in order to keep everybody on board with this this process, which unfortunately UEFA have had to do, they've had to try and hold things together, it's caused huge damage to the national leagues around Europe. Because even, you know, for Irish clubs who will play in the first qualifying round, say Shamrock Rovers playing the first qualifying round this year of the Champions League, they'll receive €250,000 for just for playing that match, €250,000. That's about half the entire playing budget of some of the teams that Shamrock Rovers play in the league. So what's actually happened, in fact, over this period is that the national leagues, as a result of the European money, have become hugely less competitive. And just to give you an example of that, in the last 30 years, take Sweden, Norway, Denmark and Scotland. In the last 30 years, 16% of the clubs which have won the national title were from outside the local elite, the national elite, the Rosenborgs and the Malmos and so forth. In the previous 30 years, the 60s, 70s and 80s, what I consider to be the real football years, the real years where the dream was alive, the dream is no longer alive. But in that period, 46% of the national competition winners were from outside the local elite. So if you take again Scotland, for example, it's just, you know, it's a game of Celtic and Rangers. And it's okay, Scotland's a bad example because it's always been a game of Celtic and Rangers. But in these other countries, it's all evolving in that direction as well.
Sure. What about that, Ken Early, that football had effectively sold its soul a long time ago? And perhaps UEFA don't have clean hands in all of this, in spite of the fine words from Alexander Seferin saying that these 12 clubs were spitting in the face of tradition and fans, because the Champions League had become, as Andrew has sort of pointed out there, it had become more and more elitist over the years, hadn't it?
Yeah, no, I mean, I agree with pretty much everything Andrew was saying. It's true. You know, again, it's hard to know what the solution is. I mean, football has tried to put up barriers to, I mean, as Andrew talked about, the way in which since Bosman, players have gravitated towards the biggest markets and the richest leagues. And that used, I mean, there's always been some markets which are bigger and some leagues which are richer, but there also used to be barriers to players being able to do that, and also there used to be barriers to people and capital moving across borders, which no longer exist, certainly not within the European Union anyway. Remember that Bosman was a European court decision, you know, it was like this is a restriction on his freedom to work, you know, it's an infringement of the four freedoms or whatever. And that's kind of been the case whenever football tries to, you know, have a foreigner rule or something like this. You know, we can only have three foreigners. You know, it has to, you know, try to encourage four, you know, leaving aside the question of whether that's an effective measure to sort of improve football in your country. The fact is that when football tries to kind of to make these sorts of rules to, you know, protect things it thinks need to be protected, these things have largely kind of been swept away now. It's pretty much an open playground for money to do as it wants in European football. I mean, what's the solution to that is, you know, I don't know. I mean, do you get the European Commission to sort of say, okay, actually sport is a kind of an exception to some of these rules? How does that sort of get through a court? I mean, these are kind of complicated questions. I mean, I agree with what Andrew is saying. But again, it's like, it's quite an intractable problem.
I think, Ciarán, that there are, I personally see two potential routes to a solution. You've got to identify the problem first. And the problem is the huge competitive imbalance caused in large part by the relative size of the markets. You know, the Irish market's a 5 million person market and the German market's an 80 million person market. So it's not at all surprising that Germany what is it, over $1 billion in media rights income, and Ireland has, the Irish clubs have zero. Now, that's the problem. So, and as with everything in football, it's a motive. So when you come up with solutions, you know, you better have your helmet on. And my view is that there are two areas of solution. The first area is on regulation. UEFA, I don't envy Alexander Seferin. He's had a very, very tough job. He's from a smaller country, Slovenia, and he has done the best job that he can do to stand against these clubs. And The beautiful thing about this threat is that they've been making it for a quarter of a century, but now they finally played their hand and they're a busted flush. That's a very, very good thing for European football, because it puts the power base back with UEFA. But UEFA needs support because, you know, I'm a former lawyer and I won't get into the detail, but basically the EU law doesn't really tend to tread that far into the regulation of football. It did with Bosman, and it can in other areas, and it would have with this Super League had it proceeded. But the first area where change can happen is a change to the regulation of the game, where it's more robust and where UEFA, with the support of the EU Commission, can stand up to these clubs and say, well, no, you're not getting vast proportions of these funds. If you take the basic principle is solidarity, the principle of solidarity, which basically means the clubs at the top of the pyramid must pour money down to the clubs lower down the pyramid, and that the pyramid must be roughly equal at each layer or level. Now, it's never been roughly equal at each layer or level, but it's become increasingly imbalanced, as we've discussed. But quietly in 2016, as part of the changes which were again demanded by those clubs, and they succeeded, the amount of solidarity payments, which was only 5% of the total money that is received from the Champions League, was quietly reduced to 4%. So you reduce it by 20%, and those clubs consider it a rounding error. For clubs like Shelburne, it's a hugely material fact. And what's the solution? The first solution is you pass footballing laws, which is UEFA's job, which increase the solidarity payments to 20% or 40%, so that you can actually invest in grassroots football in support of young people. Because at the end of the day, football, it's about the viewers and the fans, but it's about young people playing the game. And secondly, the second solution, which is a little more emotive in terms of the emotion of talking about football, is transnational leagues. And the reason why, in my opinion, transnational leagues are a good idea is the very reason that we've discussed. It's impossible for a club in a market of 5 million people with no media rights income to compete with a club that's in a market the size of Germany or Spain with 47 million people, or Italy with 60 million people. That's impossible. So, and the reason that this arose originally is just a historical fact. And the historical fact is that when the people who set up football originally set it up, they decided to, you know, create the markets around nation-state boundaries. Well, if you remove those nation-state boundaries, and as was done in rugby, and you create bigger markets, then you create a higher level of competition for the clubs who warrant playing on sporting grounds, warrant playing at the higher level of competition. So the proposal that I was involved in was to create an additional layer in the pyramid above Ireland, Scotland, Sweden, Norway and Denmark, and to take the elite clubs, which always win the National League anyway, let's face it, and put them competing against one another so that they play a standard, you know, which is more akin to their level. So Celtic are not playing Ross County, with all due respect to Ross County or Livingston, who have average attendances, I think, of 2,500 and 4,500 respectively against Celtic's 51. And you have them play Rosenborg and Copenhagen and Malmo and a club or two from Ireland. And what that does for Ireland is it means our National League, Premier League, not only carries the sporting merit of winning the competition, you also have direct access to this new layer of competition, where the best Irish club or clubs can compete against much bigger clubs. That improves Irish football for a number of reasons. First of all, the most talented Irish young players go to play for those clubs. Secondly, the solidarity payments are very significant. They're certainly more than zero, which is what we get from media rights. And they're also more than 40,000 euro, which is what Shelburne got last year from the so-called solidarity payments, which just about covers some of the kit. And so that to me is the solution, and what that gives rise to. Yes, more money, but unfortunately, money counts in football these days. And anyone who tries to ignore that fact is just wearing a blindfold.
But how does that work, Andrew? Sorry, could I just ask? I mean, is it not replicating the sort of the problem of the Super League, in the sense that, like, who would be representing Ireland in this league, and how do we decide? I mean, is it always the same club? Or number of clubs from Ireland that are in this league? Is it a thing that goes alongside the domestic league, or is effectively replacing it for the clubs that are in it? How would that work?
How it would work, Ken, is look, there are four principles of European sport: competitive balance, solidarity, promotion and relegation, open access, which is the one that was most breached by the Super League, and access to UEFA competitions. So what you do is you have an additional competition that sits above our league and the Scottish League and so on and so forth. And every year, the leading teams in the National League gain promotion to this league, and the weaker teams from the respective countries. Now, I won't get into the detail of it because you have to come up with a complex structure.
So if for instance, Bohemians won the Atlantic League and in second position was Shelburne, hypothetically. And then, beneath them were all the other teams, Bronby and Celtic and whoever. Does that mean that Shelburne would be relegated, despite having finished second in the sort of the big league? They would be then replaced by another Irish team that would come into the first
team? It doesn't. I can get into the micro detail of this if you like, but it doesn't.
I'm just trying to work out how it's different from the kind of the problem that that Florentino Perez's Euro League has of sort of saying we are the elite now, and that's just the way it's going to be from now on.
Okay, well, the first reason is that it brings back higher levels of competition to the countries who have lost that higher level of competition, so that they can access European football. So let me get into more detail. And so the essential structure, and one version of the essential structure, is that the bottom two or the bottom three clubs in the league are automatically relegated. You have a minimum proportion of clubs from each country in the league, and that minimum always stays the same, because the two Irish clubs, one of them gets relegated or may get relegated, and then is replaced by another. So you always have two, you always have five Scottish and so forth. So the bottom three clubs are relegated automatically in favour of their national champions. Okay, so then you've got two other countries whose champions haven't got access to this competition, which is a problem. Mm. And you therefore have a playoff between those two champions, and the winner plays the lowest ranking team in the competition from its country. And just to deal with your other point, as is very unlikely, it was Rovers and Shells and we came second. If you're in the top half of the league, you're not eligible for relegation, and therefore the runner-up in the national playoff that I mentioned would play its national champion. And so it's, in a sense, it's slightly American in that it's slightly convoluted, but you have to do that when you're trying to solve problems. And what does all of that do? Well, what it does, first of all, is it gives Irish fans and Irish players and Irish sports fanatics the opportunity to watch a higher level of football than we currently have, rather than our kids going to England at the age of, at a very young age and compromising their education and so forth, and with 99.9% of them coming back. What it also does is make, and this isn't particularly the case in Ireland, but it makes the National League a more competitive league, because Celtic and Rangers and, depending on how you structure it, Aberdeen and Hibs are perhaps move up to the new division. And therefore, it's a more meaningful competition. So the clubs that these days are no longer able to win the national championship, have a chance. And not only do they have a chance of winning the SPL in this case, they also have a massive opportunity to get into a much bigger league, which is huge. And it makes those clubs much more investable. It makes them much more relevant. And it makes the sporting competition much more competitive. And then to deal with your question around access to Europe, well, what you simply, you know, in your mind's eye, you have to imagine a country that is made up of five countries. It's just one country from a national league point of view, but it's five countries. So, you know, Germany has lots of big provinces. So it's like, you know, you're removing those provincial borders and creating one big league to create Germany. Well, this is the Atlantic League or whatever you want to call it. In terms of getting into Europe, you have to discuss, as we have, and engage constructively with UEFA about solving that problem and putting this league at the appropriate level of access within the access model relative to its strength. So it, you know, it'll probably fit in somewhere in the top 10, I would imagine. But, you know, that will be dictated by competition. And which clubs, and you asked Ken about which clubs would get into this competition, that's dictated entirely by sporting merit. Whoever wins the Irish National League, our Premier League, the year before this league starts, is the team in the league.
Andrew, your plan ultimately didn't come to fruition. Celtic and Dermot Desmond, I know, weren't supporters of it. But maybe you could just share with us a little bit about Shelburne at the minute. How much does it cost? What's your budget for Shelburne this season? You're in the First Division now, which is the second tier of League of Ireland football. So, you know, what are the incomings and the outgoings for a club like Shelburne?
Well, I won't tell you what the incomes and outgoings are, Ciarán, but I'll tell you that the income always equals the outgoings. We have no debt. And we break even every year because we're a responsible club.
What kind of budget, annual budget, do you have?
I can't tell you that because my competitors will hear. So, but it's not significant. And when you describe me as the owner of Shelburne, you know, owning an asset, a thing like Shelburne isn't. Oh, you're not. It doesn't go in the asset column on the balance sheet. It goes somewhere else. Look, Shelburne is a football club of huge heritage and huge history. And it's about, you know, our objective this year is for our women's team to win the Premier League. And our women's team is brilliant under Noel King. And for our men's team to win the First Division under a really talented young coach in Ian Morris. Our mission as a club is to give young people their best chance to fulfill their potential as sportsmen, sportswomen, and in life. And so, you know, it's much more than just about winning the league or whatever, which is obviously important. So to do that, we've recruited Alan Caffrey, the top sporting director in Ireland. We have Damien Duff as our under-17s coach, doing a great job. We've set up a thing called the Shelburne Opportunity Network, which is a group of 12 senior business people from different sectors who give their time for free to our kids and their parents where they're under 18 to advise them on career and opportunities and open their minds to areas they may not already be aware of. We have a partnership with St. Patrick's Mental Health Services where we promote youth and mental health issues very proactively, and we engage with schools and clubs in the area around those issues, and also, you know, we have coaching sessions with the schools and clubs with our senior players from the men or the women's side and so on. So it's much more than just a football club, and I think the same applies to in fairness many of our competitors in the League of Ireland. It's much more than just that. And, I think, and by the way, if there's anyone out there who is either a foolish investor like me or wants to get involved or volunteer, they should just contact our CEO, David.O'Connor@shelburnefc.ie.
Right. Okay. Thanks for that plug, Andrew. Ken, what about this point about heritage? It seems to have been something that was missing in this whole formation of the European Super League. They were throwing out a lot of the heritage and tradition of European club football that had been built up over many decades. And it's a curious one, isn't it? Because if you look at American sports, heritage is actually quite important in many ways. I remember being in the Red Sox stadium a number of years ago in Boston, and they have these seats that date back decades, and they're really small seats, bleachers or something they call them, and they've kept this particular section because of the heritage and the connection with the old Red Sox legacy, if you like, and the seats were sort of built for smaller people than what you have these days. And yes, that seems to have been lost on the FSG people who also own Liverpool.
Yeah, well, you know, baseball is kind of, a lot of baseball grounds are like that, these sort of nostalgic, they're like, oh, we've built this stadium to look like a 1950s baseball stadium, even though it's like, it's built according to 2010 specifications. I think it's mainly because they want to make the actual audience of baseball feel like they did when they were children in the 1950s, because it has got a really old audience, that sport. So it's kind of, there's a bit of a kind of, if you go to Disneyland and you get Main Street USA, that's what baseball stadiums are almost designed like these days. I mean, in terms of football, I just feel as though they kind of, like, why do people react badly against it? I think mainly it has to do with the arrogance of it, the kind of, we've come up with this and it's a fait accompli now, and you better just, you just have to get on with it. And people do have a reaction against it because I think like the emotional attachment to football that people have, it goes back to, their own childhood, goes back to, playing the game as kids, and how that made them feel, the sort of family members who they kind of first got introduced to football with. Maybe some of them aren't around anymore. You know what I mean? There's like powerful memories, powerful emotional associations there, which are, I suppose, tied to the structure of these competitions to some extent. Alex Ferguson talking about his, Alex Ferguson put out a statement after the Super League news broke, and he didn't really say much. He didn't sort of condemn it outright. But what he talked about was his fondness for the competitions that did exist. And how it felt like climbing Everest when with Aberdeen, he won the Cup Winners' Cup and these kind of, and how great that was. And, he obviously was feeling regretful that this was all about to be binned, or like they're kind of saying, we're going to reset the clocks to zero. It's all about the Super League now. Kind of like, you get people talking about, Alan Shearer is the top goal scorer in Premier League history with 260 goals, but like he's way off being the top goal scorer in English football history, if you know what I mean. But that's sort of, that's been forgotten about. People don't talk about that. It's kind of from 1992 is when these stats tend to date, and they kind of, I suppose, were threatening to do that again. I don't know I just feel as though people's relationship to the game is something that goes back usually most of their lives. And so there is, like, memory is an important part of it, and a move that sort of sought to just kind of bin it all, at one stroke, which effectively it would have done, for these clubs anyway, and would have affected how these league titles would have become kind of baubles, who won the English league this year? It doesn't really matter. It's not a significant competition because the main competition is this other thing. Yeah. I think that was probably part of the reason why people were reacting against it. Yeah.
Ken, where does it go from here? There have been calls for, Gary Neville has been talking about an independent regulator needed. There's talk of a fans-led review. I mean, the Champions League, as Andrew mentioned earlier, has been or is proposed to be restructured. There's also been calls for the Glazers to go at Manchester United and for FSG and John Henry to go at Liverpool.
Well, I mean, Gary Neville loves talking about independent regulator, but I don't really know what this regulator is supposed to do. Like, what are the powers vested in this regulator? How's that going to be organized? Won't the big clubs just buy the regulator? Isn't that like, does an independent regulator not usually end up in the pockets of the richest interests of whatever it is the regulator is supposed to be regulating? Is that not just what happens to regulators? I don't know if that's a magic Like, it just seems like words. I don't understand it as a solution. Like, the Glazers I don't think they really care. I mean, their interest is in the capital appreciation of Manchester United. You know, whatever causes the share price to increase in the long term is good with them. I don't think they're going to sell it now. I mean, I don't know. Maybe if you're to take seriously what Florentino Perez was saying and what a couple of the other sort of chairmen were saying when they were pushing the idea, they are in a serious economic crisis. They're losing money hand over fist and they can't make money in the current structure. If that's true, then I suppose there's trouble ahead for these clubs. But, you know, we'll wait and see. And I see Atletico Madrid have put out a statement today saying, we have we agreed to join the Super League on Monday for reasons that no longer exist. And you're like, well, I thought the reason was you were in a financial crisis. You're saying that's all been solved? These reasons have gone away? You know, it just, so I don't know. I mean, obviously Ed Woodward, the kind of manager, the front man, the greatest front man of Manchester United, has already resigned. Maybe there'll be a couple more of them, but I don't really think the owners are people. They're people who are thinking long term. You know, they want to sell the club eventually. I suppose that's the end game. But I don't think, unless that these warnings about financial crisis really are even more serious than we've been led to believe, I don't think they're going to be rushing to the market just yet.
Andrew, final word to you. What do you think happens next in this whole saga?
Well, I agree with everything that Ken said. I think what happens next is that firstly and foremostly, the American model of sport has been beaten out of Europe, and the European model has prevailed in this fiasco. And the next step, the next proactive step that should happen is Irish politicians, the FAI, who are one of the 55 members. There's only 55 votes in UEFA, and the FAI is one of them. So does Iceland, you know. So it's not difficult for those 40 countries I mentioned earlier to influence things, and it's their responsibility to influence things and to bring back the romance to the game, which Ken was talking about and which, in my opinion, is gone. And just one final point, the strange thing is happening in Irish football. League of Ireland grounds are full. Our before COVID, our first two home games last year, sellouts. I think people are moving back towards real sport and real football because there's real romance. And the Premier League, well, it's just kind of it's a polished product you watch on TV sometimes.
Okay, we'll leave it there. Andrew Doyle of Shelburne and Canary, thank you for joining us.
Good to be with you.
Cheers.
Okay, that's it for this week from Inside Business. My thanks to Ken Early and Andrew Doyle for their contributions. Suzanne Brennan produced the show with JJ Vernon on sound. Remember, you can get the latest business news straight into your inbox by signing up to our Business Today email at irishtimes.com. And you can also follow the Irish Times business feed on Twitter, LinkedIn and Facebook each day. I'm Ciarán Hancock. Until next time, take care and stay safe.